Get your exterior painting to-dos done easily with Dutch Boy Pristine Exterior Paint. With its rain-rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on Pristine Exterior Paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. All so that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On, clinical sexologist, with Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. Beginning with each show, we will, from now on, make a public service announcement. It's a disclaimer, and we will do this with each show. Here we go. The views and opinions expressed by guests on the Umbrella Hour are theirs and theirs alone, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Umbrella Hour's hosts or co-hosts or any of its officials. The information covering health and mental health care is for informational purposes only and does not replace your providers, such as your doctors, your psychiatrists, whomever cares for you. It does not replace the treatment you receive from them or the care from them. Our guest this hour is Dino Sarma, who is a 41-year-old queer man who lives in Newark, New Jersey. His life's passions include cooking, hosting parties at home for his queer chosen family, and helping to maintain safe spaces on the internet for queer folks. Hi, Dino.
Hi, Dr. An. Lovely to be here.
I'm always amazed at how Xander meets individuals in life. Tell me your story. How did you meet Xander?
Xander and I have been friends since he was in his graduate program, I believe, for conflict resolution and analysis in South Florida. I was an undergrad doing biology, and he was in grad school doing really fancy high-level like stuff. And we met at a camp run by the National Conference for Community and Justice, the NCCJ. They've been around for ages. I think they've been around since like World War I, if I'm not mistaken, when it was originally called the National Conference for Christians and Jews, where a bunch of Jewish and Christian thought leaders came together and were like, we need to have some place where we can come together at the table and have discussions about the struggles that we go through and our diversity and how to forward that, how to make it more powerful. Around 1998, I want to say, I was at high school in my Spanish class, and I saw a young lady next to me who had a field trip permission form for this 3-day sleepaway camp, and I'd never been away from my house by myself before. So I was like, what's this sleepaway camp? And she was saying, oh, it's this leadership training where they teach you how to recognize, see if I remember the tagline, bias, bigotry, and prejudice, and how to put a stop to it. So it was a series of workshops, it was a series of teachable moments, discussion groups. It was basically a holistic approach to getting across the information, how to recognize what bias, bigotry, prejudice looks like, and then what to do about it as somebody who's a youth who 99% of the time feels pretty powerless in the world, especially in 1998, before the internet really took off, and how to spot these things in your home, in your community, in your schools, and how to interrupt those thought patterns and how to interrupt those negative ideals, basically, in a way that's still meaningful, but also safe. Because the other emphasis is, if you're a little kid who's living in a house with homophobic parents who are going to send you off to conversion therapy, this may not be the time to come out. You might want to hold off on that for a minute. However, let's put you in contact with other youth in your county who are probably going through the same thing you are, who are also from the local high schools. I asked if I could get the contact information for the NCCJ to see if I could come too. And I talked at the time, the guy who was running at the coordinator was Greg Burton. And I called him and I said, hey, I would like to come to this camp. And I think I have a lot of diversity to bring. And I have a lot of experiences as the son of immigrants, as a person who speaks English as not his first language, as I wasn't out yet. So I wasn't saying queer yet, but I was saying I have diversity to bring. And so I really love to come. And he said, absolutely, let's make magic happen. Sent home a permission slip. My mom was dubious about it. So she called him, had an hour long conversation with him, had that all figured out. The first time I went to that camp, like I said, I'd never been away from my parents by myself before. So this was my first time, and it's a sleepaway camp, which was a wild experience. And the camps usually start on a weekday, on a Thursday or a Friday afternoon, and then they run through until Sunday afternoons. They wake you up at 7 a.m. to get showered, get changed, get to breakfast, which was served at 7:30. And then you would go until almost 10:30 at night. So we're talking long, intense, lots and lots of information. And you're coming face to face with things that you thought you had buried. You thought that those microaggressions, those macroaggressions, the systemic racism, the systemic homophobia, sexism, all the rest of it, they brought you face to face with it between discussion groups and experiential workshops, not experiential workshops where they made you recreate the Holocaust. I'm not talking about that because I've seen some of those cringy things and that's not what they did. This was more like sharing your experiences without necessarily having to speak them aloud if you don't quite have the tools to do that yet. So it would be things, stand silently if this statement applies to you or whatever. You've got these 3 to 4 really intense days of workshops and all the rest of it. Somehow managed to get through it. And I'm sure you can tell by now, I have a mouth on me. I'll keep talking. So I've always been very communicative with what's going on in my head and my thought processes. While I'm going through this process, I'm giving constant feedback to the counselors and to the adult advisors who were there and even to the co-director and telling them, here's what I'm feeling. Here's what's going through my head. And whatever they saw in that mix was something that they wanted to have back as a counselor. So after that first experience, Greg called me back to be a counselor. And this was 2 years before I met Xander. I'd been doing these camps every time they came out since 98. And then around 2000, when I hit college, the new guy who was in charge, Kevin, who's Xander and I's mutual friend, he was like, I've taken over the director position for the NCCJ doing these Metro Town camps. I want you. You're one of my seasoned counselors who know what he's doing. So please, would you like to come? And I said, absolutely, 100%. We're here. And around that time was when Xander came in as one of the adult advisors. And I was still technically a counselor because I was 18. And these kids are 15, 16. I'm not much older than them. So it doesn't make sense to throw me in as an adult advisor quite yet. Anyway, Xander and I met and just clicked. It was lightning in a bottle. It was the two of us got along immediately. And even after camp was done, kept in touch, even though Xander was living, you were in West Palm Beach at the time, I think?
I was in near Coral Springs.
You were a bit far from me and I was down in Hollywood. So it was like an hour drive each direction to come see me. But we would still hang out, go to coffee shops, go to that Arab shop and get food and the Turkish coffee and sit and chat for hours. And ever since then, every time there was another camp and then Xander would be there and I would be there, we would be like, hey, I see you. We're here. And so we kept in touch over the years. And the camp was the catalyst to start our friendship. But we've been going on our own steam for years. And of course, people grow apart, not because they hate each other, but because there's physically no time in a day to keep up with everybody that you love. And so every now and then, we'll just check in. Hey, are you still alive? Still okay? And so like 20 some odd years later, we don't talk as often as we'd like to because we both have insane schedules. But yeah, that's what started the whole thing. Not only meeting at camp, but also being able to have discussions about gender identity, queerness, that whole thing. Xander was one of the people who helped shape who I am as a queer man today because he was a safe person to talk to about queerness in general. To give a little bit of background, I did have older gay men mentors in Fort Lauderdale who did help mentor me in how to navigate the gay world in South Florida. But they were more talking about, here's how you navigate dating and sex and making sure that you know all the bouncers at all the bars that you go to, so that if you ever feel unsafe because someone's making you feel weird, you go talk to that bouncer that I introduced you to, who gives you a big bear hug every time you come to the bar. But that's not quite the same as having deep, meaningful discussions about queerness and what gender means and what it means to transcend what everybody else says you should be doing, quote unquote, what you should be doing with regards to your gender, with regards to your life plan, with regards to how you express yourself. And that, I think Xander's always been that mentor for me for now 20 some odd years, where we could have those conversations. That's how we got here today.
Yeah. Well, that's really beautiful, Dino. It's wonderful to hear you say that. It's it's nice to recollect. In 2000, when we met, my program at Nova Southeastern University connected me with NCCJ as my internship site during my degree program, right? There was conflict analysis and resolution. So where's a good place to apply those skills? Mm-hmm. Well, in a very diverse school district like the Broward County School District, and then through this smaller incubator experience of the Metro Town. One of the things that we did at a Metro Town, we would talk about the man box and the woman box. Mm-hmm. What's expected of you? What are the barriers around you? What does your family expect? What does your faith expect? What do your peers expect? What do you get from the media as far as the expectations of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman? Mm-hmm. And then what happens when you violate those expectations, right? And so I would be up at the whiteboard. Well, it wasn't even a whiteboard. It's probably just paper.
Paper, yep.
I'd be writing down all these words on the paper, just getting these young people to start thinking. We're talking like high school students, right?
Yeah.
Thinking about this. And then there was another exercise called the gender fishbowls, which was similar, but it was more like the idea of talking about what's the experience like growing up as a boy and being told that you can't cry.
Yeah.
How does that impact you? And so one of the things that I was able to do, this was in 2000, so that's 5 years before I started my transition. So I had a different name, I was presenting very differently, but I was still very focused on this topic. I was trans, but not transitioned. But I was given the opportunity 2 years later, actually, when I went out to California, I still did volunteer work at NCCJ. I was given the opportunity to adapt the gender fishbowls exercise to be trans inclusive.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I don't know if they still do gender fishbowls, and they might have even adapted it even more. At the time, it was not trans inclusive. We would talk about what happens when you stay inside, when you step outside of the boxes. I think we used to call it the man box and the woman flower or something. We would draw like
this. Yes, it was
like
a flower,
daisy,
yes.
Like a daisy figure, you know, like just being ridiculous with it. but because it was stereotypes. But so that I still have a copy of that curriculum that shows the new fishbowls, and it has my former name down at the bottom. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that, especially recollecting when we would go to that Arab restaurant. A mutual friend of ours, Hadar, who lives in Israel, who I talk with every week now.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And I have been in touch with Hadar every week since October 7th, as a matter of fact. I check in with her. And so she's in Tel Aviv with her family. And she worked at that restaurant. So she she was an Israeli Jewish woman working at an Arab restaurant because, I mean, let's get serious. It's the same food.
Yeah.
For the most part. It just has different names. And there's less sumac in the Israeli version of things. But other than that, she was always so shocked, or maybe I think she was insulted when I would put a bunch of tahini in my lentil soup. But, you know, that's another topic. But it's getting us on to the next topic, which is, okay, you love to cook.
Of course.
You have a cookbook.
Yes.
And you work in the rice world.
Yes.
When we were talking about you coming on the show, you were like, I love rice. I love everything about rice. And I'm like, oh, that's going to be fascinating. We got to talk about rice. So talk about rice, Dino. What do you love so much about rice? What's the thing with rice?
So as a kid, I'm from South India. So our main meal is rice, and then everything else is a side dish. The rice is the meal, and then everything else that you eat with it is meant to either flavor it or to enhance it. And that's how I'm used to eating my daily meals. When I went vegan, I want to say, 2005, give or take, a lot of the vegan cookbooks were very focused on trying to replicate the foods that people ate as omnivores, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that because we all want those comforting tastes and textures that you had as a kid. You want those same experiences. You just want to do it without harming animals. Okay, fine. But my issue was, you have these people telling you to go through 70 steps to make a veggie burger, but they don't know how to cook a pot of rice or make a pot of pasta or roast some vegetables. I was annoyed that this was the dialogue around vegan cooking back in those days. I started hanging out on IRC, which is this very old chat protocol, which is all text. It's not fancy. It doesn't have pictures. It's just text. And there were a bunch of other vegans there who would come on and say, hey, I have this. What do I do with it? I'd like to make dinner. And then I would ask, okay, so do you have this spice? Do you have this oil? Do you have this herb? And then I would come up with four or five different options for them to make. And then they would go make it and then come back and say, hey, dinner was amazing. I made it this way. What I didn't realize is that while I was making up all these recipes on the spot, somebody was actually transcribing them and keeping them in a text document. And when the owner of that chat room and the forum that went with it was like, hey, Dino, you talk about food a surprising amount. And you're giving our people stuff that they don't normally see. I think you should write a book. And I said, or I could not. And that would be great. And so he broke down all of my objections, such as it's too much work. And he's like, this guy's already got 60 of your recipes written down on a text document. We just need to edit the thing, fill it out with a couple of other recipes and you'll be fine. Get some staples in there and you'll be cool. And I said, well, I don't want to do the editing process because that's a long and painful and expensive process. He's like, I'll get an editor. That's fine. And then I was like, I don't have a publisher. He's like, I own a publishing company. That's not. So at that point, I had nothing to say. And so he put out the word on the forums like, hey, Dino's writing a book. Anybody who wants in on the testing, please let us know. We'll send you a copy. We'll give you an acknowledgement of the book, this and that. Fine. We had like 30 some odd people come on board to do the testing. And recipe testing is such that each recipe has to be tested by three different people of different skill sets so that they can double check that the instructions do what you want them to do. Because if you've seen a lot of the recipes on Google, on these websites where they have these long missives about where they learned the recipe or whatever, you can't always trust that they've been tested. So sometimes you scroll down to the comments and you see the comments are saying it's 5 stars. This looks great. I'd like to try it. Just not very helpful. So for a published cookbook, you need to have people who make the recipes exactly as you've written them and then come back and give you feedback. Cool. No problem. The writing of the recipes barely took 3 months because most of them were already written and it's just a quick question of putting them together. The testing took almost a year. And that was the biggest point. Finally, it got tested. Everything got edited, got published. And I moved to New York City at the time because South Florida was becoming very unsafe for me and my partner at the time. So we both left to New York City because we were like, this place is really, really gay. So let's go be with our people. And I was at a restaurant. I was doing a volunteer thing for some kids at NYU who were doing a talk about food security. And we're going to serve a vegan dinner at the end of it. And their budget was $50 to feed 75 people. And I said, I can do that in my sleep. That's easy. Come on, let's go. So she said, well, if you're willing to do the recipes and tell us what to do, I can get a bunch of people to help us cook. And I was like, let's do it. So she said, I'll take you out to lunch. We went to one of my favorite restaurants downtown, sat down, we're eating. And saw a waitress storm out the door saying, this guy's a thus and such, and slammed the door. The door was on hydraulics, so it didn't slam. And so as the lady stormed away, I walked up to the waitress who was there, and I said, so it looks like you have a job opening. Turns out her uncle owned the restaurant. She said, come in for an interview tomorrow, you'll be cool. So I brought my book in with me to the interview and I said, hey, I've been eating at your restaurant for a couple of years now. I really like the food style. I think that the two of our food styles are very similar. Here's a book that I got published of my vegan recipes and see what you think. And now the recipes in my book are mostly vegetables, beans, grains, some pasta, some fruit, that kind of thing. Not a lot of tofu, not a lot of seitan, tempeh, soy milk, things like that. It's mostly stuff that you can generally find more or less wherever you are in the world. I mean, yeah, there's some Indian spices that you might have to go look for, but I've had very little trouble cooking Indian pretty much wherever I go. So he went home, read the book cover to cover that night, came back the next morning, called me and was, I think we would work really well together, gave me the job. And I worked with him for about 7 years. The issue is that restaurants don't pay very well. And living in New York City, rent is not a joke. So it came to a point where I had to leave and go pursue other things. I had a couple of jobs in between, neither here nor there. Then one night I was just browsing through, I think it was Indeed or something like that. Let me see what's out there and see if I can find anything locally, because then I can find a shorten my commute. Found a job that was a mile and a half away from my apartment. And it was a rice importer who needed somebody to do import logistics and accounting. And I was like, I know how to do all those things. I know rice, I know import logistics, I know accounting. Let's go.
We are going to take our first commercial break. This is Dr. On with Xander Keg. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour, and our guest this hour is Dino Sarma. His life's passions include cooking and hosting parties at home for his queer chosen family. We are going to take our first commercial break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. Happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. And our guest this hour is Dino Sarma. Let's pick up where we left off.
So I sent in a cover letter, sent in my resume, went in for the interview, and I was like, I am perfect for this job. I know how to cook. I have been eating rice all my life. I keep about 10 different varieties of rice on hand at all times in my pantry. Depending on what you get, the texture, the flavor, the aroma, the way that it behaves in recipes will change drastically. And it's not hard to manipulate it to what you need it to do. And so at the hands of a good cook, a bowl of rice can be so many things. And it's a blank canvas. You throw stuff on there and it's going to be amazing. So he hired me, and this was in 2017, and I'm still working for him. The company has expanded. It used to be just me and him in a little office in Jersey City working together in the imports. And now I think we've expanded to about 10 people or so. He's moved the business to California. I'm in New Jersey. So I work from an office here. He works from the office in California. So basically, I start at 9 a.m. They keep going till 5:30 p.m. California time. Pretty much we're functioning much wider hours than most companies can do because we have both coasts covered. And I have seriously loved the job because I do import logistics, which means that I have to make sure that all the containers of rice that come into the U.S. from India and Thailand, which is what we do, clear customs, clear USDA, clear FDA, and then get to that final customer, whatever that may look like. But a lot of times, we will have the consumers of the rice flip the bag around, look at who the importer is, and then call us with questions about it. And I love those calls the best because then I get to talk about rice, which is one of my favorite subjects. And I didn't know how much I know until I started explaining it to people. And then I was like, oh, I already came in with a pretty wide knowledge base about rice. And now working in the industry has given me unique insights that I wouldn't have had before. So yeah, it's been a pretty cool journey. Done a lot of jobs. clearly. But this one is my favorite. People ask me, what would you do if you won the lottery tomorrow? And I'd say I'd go back to work the next morning because I love my work. I enjoy my work.
Before I was a social worker, I did a couple of jobs where I was doing vocational guidance or career transition work with Job Corps, the California Employment Development Department. And sometimes people wanted to find a job that was aligned with their passions, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a vocation and then an avocation, right? Mm-hmm. And so some people, it's two separate pursuits. They go and get a career and they pursue some passion. And then there are people who are able to take what something they're passionate about and merge it into their vocation. So they blend it together. Just the way you're talking about it, I can tell that that's what's happened, because it's not only that you have a passion for rice, you've clearly demonstrated you have a passion for talking about rice as well, right? And so that's so rare. Correct. And it's a mile away from you. All these things fell into place. You went to Indeed, you saw it, you applied, you got it. The universe was aligned for you.
But more than anything else, aside from the rice, aside from the import logistics, everything else, 99% of the job is being organized and having your act together and making sure that whatever is supposed to happen happens when it's supposed to happen. And I always loved having that level of, I hate to use the word control, but oversight, precision over things. I'm not sure if you remember at Metrotown, a lot of times people would come to me and ask me what's next on the schedule because I had the calendar and everything marked down in my notebook very clearly. So I always knew what was coming next because I have that level of organization to keep things moving along. The rice is the bonus, the organization and bringing together disparate pieces of information and spitting them out in a coherent fashion. That's the passion. That's the love. And so when I worked for an artist for a while, that's what I was doing. I was organizing his day. I was organizing his life. I was keeping everything moving. I was making sure he eats on time so that he doesn't pass out in the middle of a middle of something. Yes, the rice is there, but if it was just straight import logistics, I would still enjoy myself because I do like keeping things neat and clean and tidy and organized so that everything happens. I'm not the one who wants to own and run a business. I want to be next in command. I want to be that person's right hand. I want to be that person who makes sure that I can put my hands to information within 5 seconds of when you ask me to get it for you. So when my boss asks me, hey, where's that phone number from that one guy at that one meeting? And I know where to find it. When the customs broker says, hey, where's that document from that one container that you imported 2 years ago? And I can put my hands to it in 5 seconds or less. Or when a customer emails me and I can respond to them within 5 minutes or less, those are the standards that I keep for myself. And that's what brings me joy. That's what brings me pleasure, is being able to be that assistance for people who need it and doing it with alacrity and with enthusiasm and getting a sense of joy from it, knowing that I can facilitate the movement of information in such a way that you don't have to wait on me.
I had a job years ago where I was driving a trolley in a city park in San Diego. And people would say to me, can you listen to the radio while you're driving? I'm like, there's guests on board.
Yeah.
So you just go around and around, over and over and over and over again, all day long, day after day. And I'm like, oh yeah. And they're like, and you don't get bored. And I'm like, oh no. And they're like, how do you keep yourself engaged? Well, I'm constantly trying to perfect pulling up to the curb. I'm constantly trying to perfect taking that corner as close as I can without hitting it. I'm always learning about what's in the park. So even though I wasn't a tour guide, I would do it anyway. I would narrate. I didn't have a script, but I would just do it. I would say, you know, on your right is the such and such museum, you know, and that large tree you see there in front of you was planted by so-and-so in such and such year, right? So I challenged myself. Yeah. I wasn't bored driving around and around and around 5 days a week for months and months and months at a time. I loved it because I think it's a similar pursuit, that precision, right? To do it to the best of my ability, which I remember when I was 13, 14, my father introduced me to Taoism. And one of the things that I got from those lessons was that it doesn't matter what you do, do it with dignity.
Yep.
Right? Do it with love. If you're sweeping the floor, then sweep the floor in the best you can.
Correct.
Do it the best. Clean Correct. The toilet the best you can. There's no work that's beneath me, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever I'm going to do, I have clean toilets and I will do them to my specification.
Yep.
Right? I hear a similarity.
Also, there's a trick. They have these things called a toilet plug, FYI. It is a bladder that you put inside that big hole in the bottom of the toilet, and you can pump it with looks like blood pressure cuffs that they have that little pumpy thing. You can pump it full. And what you do is you pour water inside the bowl of the toilet and it comes up all the way underneath the rim. And what gets toilets cleaner than anything is denture tablets. So they have these denture tablets that will clean your dentures in, I think, 3 minutes or something, 3 to 5 minutes, give or take. You put in 4 or 5 of those denture tablets, close the lid of the toilet and let it just sit with that water, and under the rim gets clean and the porcelain is sparkling clean. A gentle, gentle scrub and everything is beautiful and gorgeous again.
All right. New trick for the toilet.
So I do have to jump in here because...
Of course, Dr. Ron.
I can be very organized. I'm not a cook, and that's very difficult for me. And it's all because of the timing and all the multitasking that cooks have to do.
Actually, Dr. Ron, that's an interesting point that you bring up, because this was one of the feedback that I got when the recipe testing was going on, was that, say, for example, I have a recipe for soup, and let's say it has X amount of onions, garlic, ginger, whatever, and then it has X amount of potatoes, turnips, root vegetables that take a long time to cook. And then you have those squishy vegetables, tomatoes, spinach, kale, things like that, that don't need that much time. In the original incarnation, the way I had written the recipes, chop your vegetables, because that's how you do it in restaurants. Chop your vegetables and then bing, bang, boom, just one after another, throw them in the pot in the order that they go. There's a soup that involves several ingredients. And the overwhelming response I got was the soup was really delicious, but it took such a long time to make that I don't know that I'll ever make it again. Because chopping several pounds of vegetables all at once, Dr. Ron, you know this, it's not a joke. It takes hours. And so if you're taking almost an hour or two to just chop the vegetables and you haven't even turned on the stove yet, this sounds like a nightmare waiting to happen. And then dinner happens at 12 o'clock at night and now you're tired and sleepy and, you know, whatever. So what I had to do is rejigger the recipes, re-change the instructions to how I would do it, because it's less multitasking and it's more scheduling. Before I would even get started, I just do it naturally because I've watched my mother do it all those years in the restaurant. That's how we do it. I would put a pot of water on the boil before anything starts because I know I'm going to need boiling water at some point. And then another pot would go on. And as I'm chopping onions, in they go. As I'm chopping garlic, in that goes. And then that can just park. And the boiling water can park and do its own thing. And while that's going, I'll turn down the vegetables, the onions and whatnot to a low heat and let that just do its own thing. So now if it takes me 20 minutes to chop through all the hard vegetables, the root vegetables, the potatoes and whatnot, it's fine. They're not going to burn. I don't have to go back and fuss with them. I'll put the lid on. It's on the lowest heat. Then I'll chop the long cooking vegetables and then they go in with the boiling water that I started all that time ago. Then I do the quick cooking vegetables, the spinach, the kale, the tomatoes, the whatever. The thing is, if nobody teaches you the technique on how to schedule your cooking session, then it's not fair to then ask you to somehow intuit that on your own. That's not a reasonable ask, in my opinion. And the other issue is before I start in the kitchen, I need wide open spaces. I need the counters to be clear. I need the sink to be empty. I need the dishwasher to be empty. I need the stove to be, everything has to be, because there's something that I've discovered dating, and now I'm engaged to a man with ADHD, or where if there's a barrier to entry to getting something done, it's not going to get done. So for example, he was folding away all his t-shirts and putting them in a drawer. He had so many t-shirts that there wasn't enough space in the drawer. And so when the clothes are ready from the dryer and they're clean, they would sit in the hamper because there's no place to put them. And so I can't get frustrated with him because he's not putting his stuff away because he doesn't have somewhere to put it. We had to come up with techniques. The t-shirts hang in the closet on hangers. And then that way you don't even have to worry about the drawer space. Then here's a bunch of chest of drawers with plenty of space in there so that your pants, your socks, your whatnots can go in there. Then if you run out of space there, because he has way more clothes than I do, use some of my space. We're a couple, we're together, we can share resources so that the barrier to entry drops. And sure as heck, ever since then, like clockwork, the clothes are washed, the clothes are dried, the clothes are put away, because we drop down the barriers to entry. When I would teach my cooking classes, this is the sort of stuff that I would go into. First off, clear the barriers to entry so that you're not trying to maneuver around a tightly cramped kitchen counter. So you're not worrying about, oh gosh, I can't put the dirty dish in the sink. Now it's just going to sit on the stove. Well, if that's sitting on the stove, then you can't put the next pot on the stove. If you're one of those who, like me, who puts everything in the dishwasher, if the dishwasher has clean dishes in it, you're not going to want to add. So it's like, yes, it takes a little bit more time to get that going, but I don't think it's fair to tell someone who hasn't had that shown to them. I don't think it's fair to say that, oh, you're a bad cook or you're not good enough or what. I think it's, you just haven't learned. You haven't had the opportunity to learn, and there, I'm here to teach you.
That's so interesting, because I am dysfunctional in a mess. Mm-hmm. I cannot function. Same. So my world has to be clean and organized.
Yes.
I actually don't live with people like that. Mm-hmm. I run around essentially saying, okay, let's get this moved over. Let's get that put away.
Yep.
What I hear a lot of times is, yeah, I'll do it later. And then I find myself saying, later's not going to come.
No.
It's not. It's going to be God knows when.
Correct.
I live with procrastinators. And I understand that. But there are times where I walk around asking myself, how in the bloody hell did I end up with procrastinators?
How am I supposed to get anything done?
Well, there's also the, you know, when you live with other people, Margaret and I have been together 22 years, married for 19 of those years. One of the things that you learn, well, hopefully I learned at least, not everybody learns this, I guess, is that my wife is a marriage and family therapist. So I hear sometimes some of the squabbles that go on between couples, they don't learn these things, which is, I'm a very neat and tidy person. Mm-hmm. Margaret is not a neat and tidy person. Mm-hmm. And I learned very quickly that she's going to leave something where she leaves it, because she's going to get drawn off into something else. And so I can leave it there and I can choose to not be bothered by it, or I can just put it away. I end up doing a lot of, oh, I'll put those pajamas away. I'll hang that towel up. I'll do those dishes. I'll soak that dish that you just put in the sink. You know what I mean? Because our brains work very differently. Mm-hmm. But I think part of it also has to do with the fact that I was a cook. I worked in three kitchens, in three restaurants, and I taught cooking classes. And I know that you need to have a clean surface and you need to be organized, because you don't want the entree to come out before the appetizer. No. Everything has to be timed. And so everything that's going on a plate has different cooking times and temperatures. So for me, it's about that precision and about that timing. And so that I'm the same way in the house. You know, it's like, I'm not going to fuss about it. I'm just going to either ignore it or I'm going to take care of it myself. You typically hear about the toothpaste cap. It's not that. Everybody's putting the cap on the toothpaste. I think some people are more absent-minded. They put something down. I put my keys in the same place every single day. Whereas Margaret puts them in a different place every day. They're constantly in a different place. I go understand that. My brain doesn't work that way. But I'm like, oh, guess what? Her brain works that way.
Right.
So I just accept that her brain works how her brain works. And she doesn't seem too annoyed with how neat and tidy I am. You have to learn those things over time. That's for sure. But I love that. I think that's part of it too, right? That it's like a challenge to figure out how to deal with all that stuff.
One of the coping mechanisms that I had for stuff constantly being put in different places, because that stuff drives me bonkers crazy. I hate it. The keys live here now. This is where the keys live, period, the end. They don't go on the counter. So there's a little shelf right by the door. It's one of those 3M sticky situations that you can just stick on there. This is where the keys go. This is where your wallet goes. As soon as you come in the door, that has to go there, period, the end. This is because he's lost his keys more than once. There's the meltdown that inevitably comes. And I understand getting a new set of car keys, several hundred dollars. It's not a joke. So yeah, I understand why he's upset. So he got one of those tile thingies that will let you find where your key is if you've lost it. But more than that, like I said, things have to have a place to live. If they don't have that place to live, it's very hard to manage if that's not the place where they always live. Because I watched my sister-in-law, my brother go through this exact same argument early on in their marriage, because my sister-in-law is one of those who just drop the keys wherever they land. And then at some point they get found, maybe, I guess, question mark. So what they had to do was install install key hooks next to the door so that as soon as you come in from outside, that's where the keys live, that period, the end. Granted, we're not always perfect about it. And that's also part of life, is accepting we're going to make mistakes, we're going to have stumbles, and that's fine. Right now, my apartment is looking like a tornado went through it because we just got back from IKEA. And anyway.
Say no more, IKEA trip.
I guess somebody would classify me as neurotic. I always say to people, well, if you had a break-in, you would practice differently. I've had break-ins. Yes. So I don't put the keys by the door. It's all about safety for me.
But they need to go in that same spot.
Absolutely. Correct. Yes. All right, we're going to take a second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. Our guest this hour is Dino Sarma. And it's been a very interesting conversation because we've had quite a discussion about vegan cooking, kitchens, and toilets. We hope that you have had a little bit of fun, as we certainly have. Let's take our break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. And our guest is Dino Sarma. Dino loves cooking, hosting parties, and helping to maintain safe spaces on the internet for queer folks. All right, let's pick up where we left off.
So Dino, you mentioned that you moved to New York City from Florida because you were talking about a lack of safety. And when On was reading your bio, he mentioned about queer safe space advocacy. Yes. What kind of advocacy are you doing around queer safe space?
When I moved to New York, there were a ton of queer safe spaces already there. So there were churches, there are community centers, there's LGBTQ centers all over the place. There's gay bars, there's bookstores, there's cafes. New York City is one of those places where pretty much whatever it is you're looking for, you're probably going to find it. If you're gender nonconforming South Indian person who's introverted and doesn't drink and wants to find alcohol-free hangout group with other South Asians, you'll probably find it. It gets very, very granular and very, very specific. And there's a lot of people who will attend those groups. New York didn't really need those safe spaces. So, okay, that's cool. But when I moved to New Jersey, Jersey City, which might as well be an extension of New York, if I'm perfectly honest, there were plenty of queer safe spaces, but they were more adult focused. So they were the bars and the nightclubs and the 18 and over discussion groups and that kind of thing. There weren't many safe spaces for young people, because I even remember back in South Florida, Xander, there were quite a few gay bars that had 18 and over nights or all ages nights, where if you're 16 or whatever, they would put like a wristband on you to show that you're underage. Don't hit on this kid. Kids could come hang out and then have to clear out by 10 p.m., but it was a place you could go. In Jersey City, I didn't quite see that. So that's when it started turning on in my head. Oh, wait, this is not a thing that quote unquote normal gay kids get to have. So that's when I started going on to Discord servers for LGBTQ people. A lot of them are all ages. If you're over the age of 18, you can access the over 18 channels. And if you're under the age of 18, they would lock you out of them so that any flirtatious stuff won't be going on in the general channels. It'll only go on behind the 18 and over. Fine. What I found repeatedly is that for a lot of these youth, this was the only place where they felt they could be themselves because they're surrounded by community or family or religion or any of these other structures where they don't feel safe being out. And that was my experience as well. So I completely understand where they're coming from. But at least by the time I turned 18, I had older queer mentors who would take me to these youth-friendly safe spaces. Fine. Oddly enough, in 2020, when we all went on lockdown, then that's when a lot of people started flooding onto the internet to try to find their community because you couldn't leave your house. And so what would happen a lot of times is that you'd have these youth coming on and not necessarily talking about overt abuse or being punched down or anything, but more so just feeling they're the only one who's going through this, where none of my friends are queer. I don't have any queer kids in my high school or my middle school. I don't have anyone to talk to, and I'm scared of what's happening next. Will I ever find love? Will I ever find community? Will I ever find anything? I was very fortunate that when I moved to the Northeast, I found my people very quickly. And we've been a pretty tight-knit group ever since then. And it's ever expanding. But I know not everyone is as fortunate because I have other youth in New York City and New Jersey who jump onto these online safe spaces because they're introverted and they don't like leaving their house. Fair enough. Fair enough. It's hot out. I get it. A lot of what that has involved is, first off, listening and being able to hold space for these young people to just talk. Because a lot of times when you get adult attention, the kid has to be like a performing animal. You know what I mean? Like, oh, show us your piano skill. Show us your grades. Talk about your accolades in sport or whatever. I'm sure you remember this from Metrotown too, Xander, where they finally had a space to just talk. And it didn't have to be about stuff that's school related or what they were, quote, supposed to be doing. It could just be about what they were feeling. And very few people in most spaces get a chance to do that and have somebody who will genuinely sit there and listen and then reflect back to them what it is that they said. I was teaching English during the pandemic online as well. And you had some kids coming from overseas in Singapore, Indonesia, or Southeast Asia, where they were saying, I'm scared to speak up in English class because the teacher will hit us if we make mistakes, or the teacher will shame us in public if we make mistakes. And that doesn't jive with how I function when it comes to teaching. I tend to make a space where we're going to celebrate your successes and then we'll deal with the mistake later. Right now, I just need you to open your mouth and produce English words. That's what I ask of you. And so in the same way with the queer youth that I was hanging out with in these online spaces, a lot of it was just letting them talk, letting them get their feelings out there, but also not offering advice when they asked for it, which is very difficult to do because when you're an older person who's been there, done that, seen it, the first place you want to go to is to offer advice. But the thing is that then that robs them of the opportunity to figure it out for themselves, which is what a lot of people want to do, especially when they're that young and are not respected for their agency or their intelligence or their ability to find the information that they need to find. So pretty much my attitude has been mostly, here's where I went for this information when I was looking for it. If you would like to do that as well, you're welcome to. But if you don't want to, that's cool. We can just talk. That's also fine. Or your achievements are good enough. I'm very proud of you. You did a good job. Hey, that's great. Then that transferred onto LGBTQ forums online, where initially I didn't quite understand the whole posting selfies thing. It didn't quite jive with me. And then someone told me, oh, hey, for a lot of these kids, this is the only place where they can post their pictures in a non-creepy place, if that makes sense. No one's going to try to hit on them. No one's going to try to get with them. So it's just a place where other people can say, hey, you look wonderful. Thanks for sharing your selfie sort of thing. I'm a moderator on one of those forums where there's a lot of users every day. And 99% of the time, the people who come to disrupt that space are just boring. They post the same dumb stuff over and over again that I've seen a million times. And all I have to do is delete it, ban the user, it takes 3 seconds. It's very unusual that we get people on there who are genuinely halfway decent at disrupting it, which is easy for me. That's great. But creating that space for queer people to come together online, especially those who feel like they can't do it in their real life, has been a passion of mine for a very long time. And I was doing it back when I was helping moderate the vegan forums back in like 2005 and creating a safe space for vegans where they don't have to explain their lifestyle choices to people and they don't have to explain any of it. And they can just share recipes about whatever or share life experiences and a place for them to do their thing. Online spaces have given people a community that they didn't used to have before is something that I don't think a lot of people quite grasp the importance of. People talk about how, oh, the kids are always on their phone. Well, not all of them are playing the little mobile games or whatever. A lot of them are using these online resources to reach out to each other and communicate with each other. Yeah, they're looking down on their phone because the space that you have provided for them to communicate in doesn't feel like a place that's conducive to communication. And so they're going to shut down and withdraw into their online spaces where they feel like they can say what they need to say and nobody's going to shame them for it.
Well, that's great. And thank you for creating those spaces. Well, Dino, I mean, I figured that our conversation would be fun and it would be interesting and we did not disappoint.
I don't think we did either.
It brought out new information from us too, which is always a lot of fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show. What's the name of your book?
The book is called Alternative Vegan by Dino Sarma-Weierman. It's on Amazon, but they keep getting sold out.
Good for you.
So if you can't find it on Amazon, the publisher, PM Press, sells it. And if you buy it from PM Press, it's usually a gauche more expensive than the Amazon price. However, if you buy it from PM Press, they give you the ebook version of it for free, iBooks or PDF or whatever. If you want to try some of the recipes out before getting the book, because I understand how that can be where not all of us have the money to do that, which is totally fair. I'm on YouTube under Dino Sarma.
Nice.
Thank you, Dino.
Thank you so much, Dr. An and Xander. This was amazing. I had such a wonderful time.
So did I. We have reached the end of the Umbrella Hour with Dr. An and Xander Kagg. Our guest this hour was Dino Sarma. We hope that you enjoyed it. We certainly did. Until next time, thank you for listening to the Umbrella Hour.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.